So in that case, that's exactly what's happening with LifeScale. It's getting down to the humanity of exactly what's happening in order to build a better relationship with technology, to essentially build a bridge to where we want to go, and not necessarily be navigated or driven to where we think we want to go, but we weren't fully present or committed to whatever that decision was going to be, because simply we went on the ride along with technology and just followed its every curve, and ups and downs and a lot of downs.
That was our guest today, Brian Solis, a principal analyst at Altimeter and one of the world's leading anthropologists and futurists. He's the author of 7 best-selling books, and he also studies the ways emerging technologies affect business and society. His latest book, LifeScale, tackles the challenges of living in a world with constant digital distractions, and is the main topic of this episode. You'll learn how life-scaling is not only important for people, but essential for employees, how digital distraction affected his relationships, but also his ability to complete his 8th book, and finally, how design principles can help us to live in a more balanced and effective way with technology. So enjoy the show with Brian Solis. Brian, welcome to Digital Mindfulness. It really is a pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm delighted to talk more about your work and also this fascinating new project on digital distraction that you're working on. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's truly my pleasure.
So Brian, I wonder if you'd introduce yourself to the audience and talk more about this great body of work that you've built up over the years on the impact of innovation on business and society, and also how that body of work has led you over time to focusing on, at least in part, on the impact of digital distraction on innovation and business.
For the last, oh my goodness, since the late 90s, I have in one way, shape or form been involved with emerging and eventually disruptive technologies, either advising founders and investors to how to make markets, how to accelerate adoption, to then studying its impact on markets and businesses and industries, and then ultimately as a digital anthropologist studying how those technologies affect societies, us as individuals, everything from norms and beliefs to behaviors. And throughout the years, I've written a lot of research reports, I've written a lot of books, and ultimately in the last 2 to 3 years, I found myself affected by those technologies that I had been studying all these years, in the form of not being able to actually write what would have been my 8th book. And also noticing over the years that my attention and my depth and my creativity had suffered or struggled. I didn't know what the cause was, maybe just blaming writer's block or blaming just being busy. But ultimately, I spent a good year and a half, to research what might have been behind what was affecting me, because I didn't really know at the time what it was, and ended up just uncovering through a lot of friends. I live in Silicon Valley, through a lot of friends who are designers at a lot of well-known companies, everything from Apple to Facebook to Google, understanding a lot of the design techniques that were going on behind the stuff we use every single day, and why those design techniques were used, and the intent that went behind that, and then ultimately continued to study the effects of that, and then ultimately how to fix it. And I failed on delivering my 8th book, but this is what ultimately became my 8th book. It was a book I needed to not just recover, but actually get to a better place, because I wasn't going to abandon technology. I need it in my life and in my work. I was going to find a way to manage it and be more mindful in how I use it.
For me, I'm really interested to find out more about what went on in those discussions about the design choices that were made. But I'm really interested to know, was there a specific point at which you became aware of the effect technology was having on you personally and your productivity? Was it when you sat down to write this 8th book that was difficult for you, or did it come beforehand?
This is and was one of the most paradoxical things to try to answer, because I never knew I was distracted until I failed to deliver that book. And then I still had to research what was going on and what was happening in my life. I had to go through some incredible soul searching and reflection, and then further research. And the quandary that I face today is, how do you sell a book about digital distraction and overcoming that to people who don't know that they're distracted? And that's the art and the science of a lot of what's going on behind the design of these devices and apps, is that they're meant to distract you. They're meant to reward you and give you the sensation that being distracted is actually a good thing, and that you're more important, and that you're loved, and that everything's, there's no FOMO, and that you're constantly plugged in and networked and popular and engaged and living your best life. And all the while, actually, what it's doing is it's rewiring how your brain works. It's completely resetting how you operate physical and digital communication. And more importantly, it's affecting how you work. So, for example, when you reach for your phone, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat or whatever it is, let's just say you're in the middle of writing an email, or you're writing a book, in my case, or an article, or anything, whatever it is, if you were in any way, shape, or form focused on that work, and then you reach for your phone, it takes about 23 minutes to get back into that similar zone, right? And so we get about, you know, just the average person, 200 notifications a day. You multiply that about how, you know, whether it's 20 minutes or whatever it is for you, getting back into that groove, you're really looking at a great deal of disrupted lost time of productivity. But lastly, you're getting rewired for that to be normal. So you don't necessarily know your work is suffering, the quality or the caliber of your output is suffering, because you're still sort of focused on getting that task done, and not necessarily on how long that task took. But in the end, if you were also measuring the level of creativity, originality, individuality in that work, you would also see that that was going away. And then lastly, what I want to add is the other thing that I found, and that we don't talk about enough, is the effect of distractions on our relationships, on our friends, our family, our loved one. When you are wired to be distracted, and you're constantly looking at your phone, but maybe even trying to be present with whomever you're with or wherever you're at, we think we're doing a great job at it, but we're not. Just like we think we're doing a great job at multitasking, but we're not. And unfortunately, the only reason that I've failed on this, or the only reason that I really wanted to get to the depth of understanding what was going on, was because of that great failure. We're a single income family, so my family depends on books and speaking and research to live. And it's not inexpensive to live in Silicon Valley. And so I had to figure it out. There was no choice. Like, I'll just move on to something else. I had to figure it out. And I don't know that sense of urgency is there for anyone else, unless you hit, you know, rock bottom, or like somebody who's addicted or just say dependent on some other substance. Yeah, you know, sometimes they have to have an intervention or hit rock bottom until they figure out they have a problem. So that's the quandary of what's happening today, that it's so effective in keeping people engaged, because attention is the currency in which they trade, that a lot of us don't realize what's actually happening to us.
This is absolutely true, Brian. And I'm really interested to know, from your research as an anthropologist on this book, was this the consensus of everyone, particularly the workers in Silicon Valley, that the effects of digital distraction were having a measurable or important impact on the quality of their productivity or their work or on their relationships?
Once you start having these conversations, the secret starts to come out with those who know the secret.
Right.
Because then you're part of this secret club. that no one is proactively talking about. You have folks like Tristan Harris, and you have folks who have been whistleblowing for years now. But you know, the audience that they have isn't necessarily my mom or my wife or my friends. And I needed to bridge that gap. I believed I couldn't be alone in this, and the solutions that people often talk about, at least the popular solutions that you see on TV or read in mainstream magazines or in Google search results, are all sort of dealing with the, you know, with the symptoms like unplug, turn off your notifications, delete these apps. You don't need to be on Facebook. Get the Calm app or Headspace. Practice meditation. Go to Burning Man. You know, whatever it is. They don't necessarily get to the heart of the matter. And I think what's really important is that once you open this door, it's like the Matrix, you know, which pill do you want to take? Because one of them allows you to forget about everything that's going on. The other one actually changes your life forever. And I believe in a good way. And that's what LifeScale, which is the new book that I wrote, was about giving ourselves a manual for life that our parents and their parents didn't necessarily foresee. So for example, even though the world has continued to change, obviously, and media has continued to change, that we did not have modern definitions of success and happiness. And we didn't have a realistic framework for how to live this really incredible, accelerated, fast-paced, multitasking life that our parents are still trying to figure out, or our teachers are starting to figure out, or our managers are trying to figure out. Nobody really has the answers because none of this stuff really existed. It's sort of like giving everyone a taste of what micro celebrity feels like, and once you taste that, it's intoxicating, it's seductive, and the chemicals that are releasing your body as you're using these devices and the way your brain is starting to rewire and work is just constantly telling you that you're on the right path, that you're the center of the universe, that all of these things are happening for a reason. And then you're so far down the path that your center of reference and how you make decisions around life is no longer where it used to be. So the values, the foundations, the principles that we based our entire lives on, and what success looked like and what happiness looked like, are suddenly outdated. And yet we're still holding on to those as these standards. And in my research and also my soul searching, and like any kind of effective treatment for substances, you realize that it's not just the substance that you're contending with. It's you're actually resetting your body, right? It's like when you come off of whatever substance it is, your body has to you actually get sick first, and then has to get better. And you have to strengthen that getting better in your mind and your spirit. And all of these things are sort of part of an effective recovery process. And so I use this as a means to kind of get back to basics. What's important to me now that I've tasted the dark side and what I knew of this of everything else before, what I knew about my creativity, my productivity, my happiness, you know, which all of these things were completely affected. I was not happy. I was not the best father. I was not the best husband. And once you go through these exercises that I had to go through, the LifeScale journey, you're essentially just setting a foundation for life moving forward with the full knowledge that there are going to be more distractions, there are going to be more technologies, there are going to be more trends, but that at least you're in a better, you have a better, stronger center of reference guided with purpose and values and vision that are modern and relevant. And it's not a one-time thing, but you are in a much more capable place to be successful and happy.
I think that's a really important point to elaborate on, because of course, being an anthropologist and, you know, with the rest of your books, you're not just looking at the effect that digital distraction has on people, but I think more importantly, what you're doing in LifeScale is to draw out a framework by which people can live and work more productively and more impactfully with technology.
Thank you. I will say that it's not easy, right? And I'll tell you that I tried to read other books to solve this problem. I tried to I just tried everything. And ultimately, I didn't even see myself writing this book. I was just trying to get back to the other book that I had started. And I remember the moment. I was in Lake Tahoe, and I was just sitting at a dining table, and I thought, you know, all this research has to be stitched together, and has to be put together in a way that I need to follow, because I got to get back. I got to get back now that I've seen all of the darkness and the things that I hadn't even seen all of these years before. I made the conscious decision that I wanted to fix it. I wanted to be better. And so I started to life scale this. I started to draw out the life scale journey. And then I talked to my publisher and said, hey, a new idea for a book that's nothing like any of the books that I've ever written. And I don't have I'm not known for this. And it's definitely bigger than any audience I've ever been able to, any community I've ever been able to build. So I want to take a chance on it. And even in the first couple of pages of the book, it says, so thanks for coming along with me on this journey. I just want to be completely honest with you. I don't know, as I write this, I don't know what's going to be on the next page. I don't know what this entire journey is going to look like. But what I am committed to is finding actually what works and putting it together on each page so that you get the benefit of going through a journey that's going to be transformative and that's going to unlock happiness and creativity, because they're interlinked. They're scientifically interlinked. And more importantly, to express yourself, even in the smallest or slightest forms of creativity, is actually going to make you better in all of the things you do. You don't have to be Van Gogh, but just the practice of any form of it is going to make you more creative, more original, truly, truly authentic. And that's what this world needs now, in a time where everybody has access to the same filters, the same capabilities, the same experiences that we're all trying to live, and that we're expressing those in every feed, that you actually are original. And that's what stands out. And that's going to be the source of not only your happiness, but you as a beacon for happiness and an epicenter that hopefully is contagious, that people start to see and want to be more like.
So, Brian, I'm going to put my editor's hat on just now. And the question that I would ask you, if you were to bring me the manuscript for Life Scale, is I would want to know, how does this book and how does this journey that you're taking audiences on with this book and with this framework, how does it fit into your larger body of work in terms of identifying, tracking the impact of technology and innovation on business and society?
It is a standalone in of itself, and I have big ideas around this. My creativity is on fire right now, and the book itself. I always recommend the print. Last three books that I've written, the one thing that they all have in common is that I studied UX and UI, ironically, to take the best elements out of mobile design and apply them onto paper. So essentially, wireframing an analog app to make it much more experiential, intuitive, and more importantly, essentially trying to navigate a very complex rewired brain to help people still read in what's essentially a linear format. And so the design of Life Scale is meant to emulate an artist's sketchbook, so that you're feeling that creativity as you're turning each page, and that it brings joy and a really positive experience to you as you're going through some pretty hard exercises of essentially reprogramming your life. The way that it fits intellectually and philosophically into the other work is that over the years, I've studied how technology was changing. For example, in the last two books, I studied how technology was changing how customers make decisions about which brands that they want to be with, or which products that they want to find or buy, what makes them happy, what are their expectations and preferences. And so reverse engineering the effects of technology on that decision making was essentially humanizing how to be more relevant to them, how to be more engaging, how to deliver value, how to deliver meaningful and memorable experiences to this different consumer that I dubbed Generation C, where the C standard for connected. It wasn't an age group. It was more of a lifestyle. It was more of a psychographically linked group than age or income or education. So the thing about, and all of my research too, the thing about it that is constant in all of my work is that I get to the human, I get to the humanity of it all, and then using technology as an enabler to essentially build bridges and build better experiences. So in that case, that's exactly what's happening with LifeScale, is getting down to the humanity of exactly what's happening in order to build a better relationship with technology, to essentially build a bridge to where we want to go. And not necessarily be navigated or driven to where we think we want to go, but we weren't fully present or committed to whatever that decision was going to be, because simply we went on the ride along with technology and just followed its every curve and ups and downs and a lot of downs. But with that though, it is the first piece of work that's written and designed for the mainstream audience. So whether, and I'm specifically going after moms and dads and teachers and therapists and psychologists and medical professionals and just church pastors, anybody who helps people or has an audience of people looking for guidance or direction, because this affects, you know, you could be a teacher at middle school and practice life scaling for these kids at, you know, at such a formidable age, and really trying to just help and guide people have better understanding of what's happening, and then give them the power to choose what they want to do. A lot of people aren't going to want it, but there are a lot of people, and we need a lot of people to take control, because if you look at any group of kids in middle school and how they use phones, at first blush you're going to say, wow, they just can't put their phones down. Everything that they're doing is online. They're constantly playing games. That's how they watch their TV. That's how they communicate with everybody. And that seems like a new normal, and we try to understand that and make sense of it. But at the same time, what's happening behind the scenes is that their self-esteem is plummeting, their self-confidence is eroding, their intellectual capability and how they communicate or work through complicated processes or critical analytics or thinking, those things are eroding because they're not getting the skill sets to build that foundation. They're getting a whole new set of skill sets, and we're trying to teach them in analog formats and in old standards and old ways, and all of that has to upgrade and update. But we have to understand what's happening behind the scenes. And I know this is a long answer, but I'll tell you one more quick story, which was another bit of research that was timely as I was going through this whole rebirth or rediscovery, was doing a research project for a global beauty brand directly for the global CEO, where, you know, he wanted to know what are the effects of Instagram and Snapchat and other apps like that on beauty, so that we can understand today's woman and how they define beauty and how they feel and how they want to feel, so that our brands, our products, our touch points, our engagement is actually more in alignment with who women are and who women are becoming. And I interviewed women from age 6 to 61, and I have to tell you that it was a very dark but also enlightening body of research, because when you're asking these questions of, you know, why someone uses Facetune, or why someone posts so many selfies, or why everybody believes that they're an influencer today. And then you start asking other questions, you know, as you get deeper into the interview. How do you feel? How do you feel when you see this? How do you feel when you share this? How do you feel when you get this response? How do you feel when you don't get this response? Ultimately, the questions really were designed to open the person up more and more and more. And eventually, pretty much everybody in the interview process would figure out that there was a problem, and they would really start to open up, and every single discussion would always shift from a research interview to therapy, and they would just start to unload, and they would start to realize, like, I never thought about it that way. You know, I've been feeling these things. You know, let me tell you a story. And just in that time of getting to that place with every single one of them and recognizing that if I still had more time or more sessions with them in the weeks to follow, how far I could get into their lives and how much I could unpack and how much I could then start to fix. It was incredible. And knowing that if I hit that almost 100% of the time in these interviews, then imagine what parents are completely missing, or teachers are missing, or therapists or psychologists are missing right now. And that was really compelling to be part of this whole thing, is that you don't know what you don't know. You're just living life. You think this is the new normal until somebody points it out or something happens to you, like in my case, and then you do something about it.
I think for me, it's really heartening to hear that that these discussions and these insights about the ways that these digital services and tools impact our sense of beauty are going up to the level of the C-suite. So I think that's really fantastic. And it also strikes me that the work that you're doing with LifeScale, that we've been talking about how this could apply, say, to at the consumer level, but also I'm thinking that applying a framework like this within the workforce for employees would be equally, if not more so, important.
So in my day job, when you have things like customer experience being the number one catalyst for digital transformation in business today, you have to imagine that the same things affecting how a customer makes decisions are the same things that are affecting an employee experience and how an employee works and how an employee wants to work. And so if you're able to find ways to engage an employee, understanding that these dynamics are happening behind the scenes, understanding that they don't even realize that they're losing upwards of 2 hours a day from their work time because of these distractions, that there's an angst and anxiety issues that are happening behind the scenes that a lot of us haven't even started to put our finger on yet, but we know that there's something there. We know that we're feeling these things, or we know that we're becoming more impatient, or we're snapping at people more, or becoming more and more difficult to work with. All of those things are happening every day to great extents within the workplace, and that they're losing, I can't even estimate, but got to be billions of dollars of productivity. And also just the rising amount of unhappiness, which is probably going to lead to low morale, which is going to lead to further productivity issues, that any company that wanted to be innovative would start by being innovative in how it engages its human workforce and how it motivates it and how it rallies it to be better and to be more mindful and to be happier. And there's technology tools, but you have to first understand what's happening. You have to first be empathetic. And that's what a lot of management misses today, because they're so busy working on the numbers and the performance and all of the things that they're measuring success by today, which is how I think a lot of us were brought up. You have to be successful. You have to go to school. You have to go to university. You have to buy a car, two cars. You have to buy a house. And those same standards that everybody's working towards in terms of human resources and performance are also dated. And so they could also benefit from life scaling. That this affects everything. That I believe that there's companies like, for example, Gaping Void, who have figured out that art and communication, not employee engagement in the form of corporate communications, but understanding how people work, how people want to work, the aspirations that they're looking for, the leadership that they're looking for, and to do these installations that put a narrative within the company to put them on a path towards greatness. That all these things work, and studies show that they work, but you have to essentially hit the C-suite to say, if you're prioritizing your customers and trying to humanize them in ways that allow you to be more relevant and engaging to them, the same process has to work with your employees. In fact, one could argue that it should start there, because happier employees are clearly contagious, and it spills over into coworkers and also to customers.
So focusing a lot more on the actual life scale process, what are the most important points, or what would you say are the very first things people should be thinking about when conducting a life scaling exercise?
Well, the journey is one that is meant to bring you along softly at first, but also the steps that you need to take. First, to understand what's happening. Second, to even start to build a little bit of the the bit of the muscle, if you will, to focus on actually getting better. That was what was really interesting to me, is that how do you fix things if you don't have the depth or the creativity to get to those states, those mental and physical states. And so the journey itself is just, I think it's about 15 steps, of which kind of walk you through this process of awareness, and also the beauty of actually what change would look like and what it looks like and the steps that you take to get there, with starting with things like just even simply visualizing where it is that you want to go and putting together the steps that would get you to some of those things, you know, short term and then long term, measuring, giving you some metrics frameworks that show what progress looks like towards those and what distractions look like when you take away from those. But most importantly, you don't have to read Life Scale if you're not ready to completely transform your life. Just even getting through the first few chapters are, I say that if ignorance is bliss, awareness is awakening, that there is, just to know what's happening when you touch your phone, for example, is, I think that's that level of power that you give yourself is already life-changing. You can't unsee that. You can't unsee what they've intentionally done to get you to use that device more and more and more. And you should know that. The fact that we don't is unbelievable. There's a lot of comparisons today that, you know, at one point in popular culture, smoking was endorsed by doctors, and a lot of companies actually repressed the information about just how dangerous smoking was to us. And it took a lot of really great people spending a lot of great deal of time and money to bring that information out to the public en masse. And people still smoke. But for the most part, what we're talking about is social change. And that has to start with individuals, and that has to collectively bubble up to societies. And it has to start somewhere. And that, I think that starts with us. And so until that time, where we have PSAs all over, you know, YouTube and television, and that this is an individual journey. And then lastly, the steps that you take if you do decide to continue reading Life Scale, essentially what you're doing is you're giving yourself a modern framework for happiness and creativity, of which what I hope is something that you then share with someone else, because this is not as effective for the world when it's just you and me. It's a movement, and it's a movement that's bigger than me. I made the decision to be more present with my family. Ironically, at a time when you have to market a book that I think has great impact, and so I'm hoping to partner with the readers of this book to make it a movement that's under the Life Scale banner, not the Brian Solis banner, and that together we can share this with those that we care about and those that we love, so that we're changing the society one person at a time.
You know, Brian, it really sounds that the awareness of the problem and then the act of writing the book has had a transformative effect on you, not just personally, but professionally as well.
It's true. And thank you for saying that. The book is 50,000 words, but I wrote over 100,000 words. I didn't want to stop. It was just, I could keep going. I could have kept going. Everything that I was learning, the journey doesn't have to stop there, and it won't. It's just, there's too much that I've learned, but it was just beautiful, and it still is. And I actually am rereading the book and find myself just completely smiling a lot of just how transformative it's been.
So Brian, where can people listening find out more about Life Scale, your work, and also connect with you?
Well, there's lifescaling.me is the book URL, but the book's available everywhere that books are sold, and maybe you could support your local bookshop. If you want to learn more about me and my work, it's a lot of it's at briansolis.com, and I do stay on social media, but use it in a as positive and productive way as possible. And it's at Brian Solis pretty much on everything. And also on the lifescaling.me website, you'll see the LifeScale social profiles. And we're using that to share real positive stories and, you know, create a community so that there's a bright light in all of the chaos online.
Well, Brian, look, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and telling us more about your research journey and, more importantly, about LifeScale. So thank you very much again.
Thank you so much for the time, and thank you for sharing your platform with me. And I really enjoyed this conversation, so thank you.